On two previous occasions, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with best-selling author Earl Swift. The first occasion was to talk about his book called The Big Roads, the untold story of the engineers, visionaries, and trailblazers who created the American superhighways, a thorough and absolutely fascinating look at how the roadways of America took shape. Our second conversation was about an equally interesting book and a really uncommon book called Autobiography, a classic car and outlaw motorhead in 57 years of the American dream, in which Earl Swift, amazingly, was able to trace back over the course of many decades all of the owners of a given car and their particular stories. A thoroughly engrossing book. And once again, Earl Swift has written an absolutely marvelous book. This one, however, quite different from at least those two, a book called Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. This is a small island in the Chesapeake Bay, and it, like other islands before it, is rapidly disappearing with the encroachment of rising ocean levels. And with it, in this particular case, we are talking about the really important and touching and troubling story of what should we do about this. Not only kind of the bigger question of climate change, which is very likely a huge contributing factor to this, but also what is to be done in terms of trying to preserve a place like Tangier and the several hundred people who live there and their beautiful way of life. What is the cost of that? Is it even possible to seriously think about a way to preserve this island and the people who live there and their way of life? Lots of intriguing questions raised in this interesting book, and Earl Swift, by spending extended amounts of time on Tangier Island, really grew deeply acquainted with its inhabitants and with the interesting life that they have there. The book, again, is called Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island, published by Day Street, an imprint of William Morrow. Earl Swift, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Greg, thank you so much for having me. It's a thrill to be back.
I am really, really excited to be talking with you. So explain to our listeners your own connection to Tangier Island and the first opportunity that you had to visit it.
Well, my connection to the island begins in 1999. I was a newspaper reporter in Norfolk, Virginia for 22 years. And in 99, my editor sent me up to Tangier to do a profile of the island. And it was an anniversary piece, kind of a journalistic convention, looking at how the island had fared over the years since it had voted not to allow the state lottery to sell tickets there. Tangier being one of the very few towns in Virginia that had banned the lottery on moral grounds. This is a deeply religious, very politically conservative community. And at the time, it was a near theocracy of old school Methodists. Anyway, I went back later that year to spend Y2K there. I passed the millennium on Tangier, and given that it is a dry island, it was, I'm betting, one of the more quiet millennial celebrations on the planet. and on both of those visits, I heard islanders talking about one thing that was quite clearly on their minds, and that was that the Chesapeake Bay, which maroons the island from the rest of America, the Chesapeake Bay that had for generations supplied them with its bounty. Tangier has made its principal living from seafood from day one, starting with fish, later with oysters, and for the last more than 100 years, the Chesapeake Bay blue crab. But this bay had sustained them, that had sustained them for so long was now threatening their very existence, that the erosive power of waves coming in from the west was tearing at the island, and you know that it was shrinking almost before their eyes, and clearly they were worried about it. And so I arranged with my editors to send me back with a photographer, a guy named Ian Martin, and we spent the next 6 weeks on and off on Tangier in the spring of 2000. And I got to know the island much better, and a few islanders quite well. And then I left, and 15 years passed. And during those 15 years, I lived in a couple of houses on the water in Norfolk, on an estuary branched off of the Chesapeake. And with each storm, it seemed, though, the water came higher into my yard and into my basement and into my neighborhood. And it didn't really even seem to matter how severe the storm was. The water just kept coming. And it got me thinking, God, if it's this bad in the city, what's it like up in Little Tangier? And so in the fall of 2015, I resolved that I would go back and find out. And before I could, an academic journal called Scientific Reports issued a study by three researchers associated with U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that identified Tangier pretty much as a canary in the coal mine for sea level rise, and said that the island had no more than 50 years probably before it would be uninhabitable. And since, of course, I found out that was a wildly optimistic view.
It right. And of course,
2025.
Right. And in one of the most quoted lines from that report, the article ended with this: the Tangier Islands and the town are running out of time, and if no action is taken, the citizens of Tangier may become among the first climate change refugees in the continental USA. In other words, they are bearing the brunt of the consequences of climate change in a way that most of us on a daily basis are not. But it is, in a sense, a foretaste of things to come in terms of the ultimate fate of Tangier.
Yeah, it is. And part of that, of course, is a function of the island's topography, which is almost non-existent. I mean, this is a wafer of mud and marsh that covers 1.3 square miles. It's very small, a squiggle, really, in the middle of 18 trillion gallons of often tempestuous water. There's a lot of wave action in the Chesapeake Bay. It's a shallow body of water, so it builds waves very quickly. And unlike waves in the Atlantic, say, which, you know, are giant oceanic swells, these are very corduroy. They're vertical waves, high frequency waves, and they batter ashore. And you know, on Tangier, the highest point of land is 5 feet. Most of the island doesn't clear 3 feet. And actually, most of the island is salt marsh that doesn't clear one. So it's the effects of just the day in, day out tidal comings and goings of the water are dramatic to a degree that you don't see, you know, on every piece of coast that we have. We have 88,000 miles of shoreline in the United States. Tangier is just so wide open to weather from any point in the compass that it really does, it is set apart for that reason.
Hmm. And so you ended up living on Tangier for, how long was it when you visited for the purpose of studying it and ultimately writing this book? How long were you there?
I took up residence in May of 2016, and I stayed for the next 14 months. Okay. And rented the second floor of a house on one of the three ribs of dry ground on an island that is otherwise salt marsh and floods at high tide, and spent my days trying to go as native as I could. I went out with crabbers in their boats in the pre-dawn dark. I went out with oystermen. I spent a lot of time in church. Again, this remains a near theocracy, an island so conservative that it wouldn't allow it. A Kevin Costner movie of a Nicholas Sparks novel to film there, so because of scenes of beer drinking and PG-13 sex.
Hmm. I want to ask you, since you kind of mentioned the fact of actually living there and of what you spent much of your time doing, really living amongst the people of Tanger Island, getting to know them thoroughly, and even attending church there on quite a regular basis. I mean, at one point when you're describing one of the two churches on Tanger Island, you talk about your usual seat. So you didn't just pop in there once or twice, even though you say something about you yourself not really being a very religious person at all, and otherwise would not have been in church except for the purposes of studying Tanger Island. I wonder if you could just say a word about what it is like to live someplace and to be studying people in this way, and to what extent you end up, in a sense, masking who you are and how different you are from the people that you are studying. I mean, is it ever a source of sort of awkwardness to be amidst people who see the world so differently from the way that you do? And do you have to, in a sense, go out of your way to mute your own opinions that probably in many, many cases differ drastically from the views of just about everything of the people around you?
Well, great questions. First of all, let me establish something about Tanger. This is a community so isolated, despite the fact that it's less than 100 miles from Washington, D.C., this is a community so isolated that it has its own style of speech. It's one of the few towns in the East that you can't drive to. You know, you can go by small plane. Most people, though, their lifeline to the rest of America is Crisfield, Maryland, a mainland port that's 12 miles off. So when you go on Tanger as a reporter, when you take up residence there as I did, I'm not the only one doing the studying. I was under intense study for the entire time I was there. It cuts both ways. You know, they're sorting me out. This is a single extended family in which every island-born person can trace his or her lineage back to the original settlers of 1778. You know, they are very in tune with each other. They have a very effective landline telephone communication system, a network that can spread the word on something lightning fast. When you undertake a project like this, you undertake it knowing, not only am I going to be trying to get their story, they are going to be actively assessing me at the same time. I am no atheist. I'm not a religious person, meaning that I'm a lapsed Catholic. I was raised Catholic. But that does not mean that I'm without spiritual inclinations. And so it wasn't that dramatic a departure for me to get swept up in Tanger's reliance on the word. It's a very different style of worship than I had ever been exposed to, but that made it all the more attractive and intriguing to me. I just found it to be in many ways, it's a very practical, very pragmatic approach to worship. This is, church services there are not only occasions for worship, but they're, again, a communications outlet. During prayer requests, for instance, at the beginning of every service, you find out what's ailing everybody who's sick on the island, and you also find out what great news someone might have received over the course of the last few days, worries that they might be having. It's an island with very few secrets, and most of them come out at church.
And really, it would be impossible to understand Tanger Island and the people who live there without studying this really central facet of that community.
Well, I think that Tanger is certainly no stranger to visitation by the media for more than 100 years now. magazines and newspapers and then sending reporters to Tangier. And almost invariably, they spend a night, if that, and then they're gone. They're, you know, it's a quick hit. They parachute in, you know, do a few interviews, soak up the culture to the degree they can, and leave. And so, you know, the same, what you wind up with is the same variations on the same story done again and again and again. And a mistake that so many of these journalists make is that they don't go to church. Mm. They don't time their visits so that they can. And that's, that is just essential. That is, that's Tangier's compass. You know, that's what gives, and this is a, this is an island in which the principal way of making a living is to go out, no matter what the weather, in a little shallow draft boat in an often tempestuous bay. And, you know, faith is a waterman's, you know, that he has to have that because you know, sometimes it's all he has.
Mm. How about the conversations that would occur that you would witness and chronicle in which, for instance, people would be by and large expressing ferocious loyalty to Donald Trump or talking about how there is no such thing as climate change. Typically, were you just there in a sense sitting mutely?
Oh yeah.
So it had nothing to do with your own opinions, and
I wasn't
and
there to get my story.
Right.
Yeah, my story was immaterial. My thoughts on the matter. Who cares?
Right. I mean, I just think about what it's like. Maybe at somebody's Thanksgiving dinner table, when you might be sitting there with relatives and you choose not to engage in disagreement over, for instance, political differences or whatever they might be, but that's not always easy. What was it like to sit there and hear these conversations in which you would hear extremely conservative viewpoints that you sort of hint at being different from your own? Was that difficult, or is that just something a journalist does and not a particularly difficult thing to weather?
You know, I've done it for so long. Now, true, on Tangier, I was exposed to a much more unified brand of thinking than I had seen when I covered politics on the mainland back, you know, in my newspapering days. But the, I don't find it all that difficult. There are times when people say outrageous things, and I might gasp, but you know, I keep my response otherwise to myself. I watched the first presidential debates between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump with the mayor of Tangier, a deeply conservative man named Uker Eskich, who's a good guy, and Uker kept up a running commentary throughout the debate, which I did not agree. His commentary was play-by-play that I wasn't sure I was seeing on, you know, it didn't reflect what I was seeing on the screen. But I don't think I said a single word to counter him, and I just didn't feel the need. I'm there to get their story. Mm. And, you know, I did not subject them to mine. It seemed unnecessary, and B, kind of counterproductive. My role in doing this kind of, you know, deeply immersive reporting is to be a fly on the wall. And if you're going to be an effective fly on the wall, that the fly can't be sitting there shouting his opinions. I listened. I just shut up and I kept my ears open. Hmm. And I always had a notebook in hand. Whenever I in all of the many conversations that I relate in the book, if for instance at the daily afternoon coffee clatch of old timers that they call the Situation Room, those guys could see me writing as they spoke. So there was never any question as to what I was doing there. And I would participate in the conversation just to make conversation on occasion. But and I reflect a few of those conversations in the book as well.
Hmm.
But in the main, I was there to hear their story.
And, we're speaking with Earl Swift, and we're talking about his latest book, which is called Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. Let's have you describe a little more specifically the way in which Tangier Island is vanishing. And there are a couple of different ways to think about this, and I think it would be important for our listeners to hear both from you. First of all, in terms of, and I think maybe you've already said something to the effect about how rapidly the island itself is, in a sense, vanishing. That is, from the encroachment of the waters of Chesapeake Bay, and also vanishing in terms of its population, the people who choose to live on Tangier Island. Give us some sense of, in both respects, how rapidly Tangier Island is vanishing.
Okay, well, let's talk about the physical island first. It's a there's not much to it to begin with. The island is about 3 miles long by about a mile wide. 70% or more of it is salt marsh that barely clears the tide and floods at high tide. And since about 1850, the federal government has been able to chart the island's size and has found that it has lost two-thirds of its land mass since that point, basically since the Civil War. It averages to more than 8 acres a year. Now, that is accelerating. For much of the 19th century, that was ascribed simply to wind-driven wave erosion, mostly on the western side of the island, where you have the great mass of the Chesapeake Bay stretching all the way to the western shore, and a lot of what mariners call fetch, a lot of room for wind to build waves. And accelerating through the 20th century, and then and now really accelerating quite dramatically, is the level of the water itself. It I think through the 20th century, sea level rise in the Chesapeake Bay averaged about 1.7, 1.8 millimeters a year, which sounds so completely insignificant, you know, about a 16th of an inch. But that little 16th of an inch makes a tremendous difference in the erosive power of waves. Every little bit that water climbs, the more powerful the punch that the bay packs when it comes ashore. And this is not a sandy shore where the waves roll in and they roll up and over the edge of the island. This is a peaty, dark-soiled island in which the waves come in and just slug it, and tear off huge chunks and carry them away. So there's that. There's the accelerating water level rise, which feeds the erosive power of waves. The most diabolical part of the island situation is where it's located. It's in the middle Chesapeake, and the middle and lower Chesapeake are experiencing subsidence of the land. The bed of the bay, all the land around it, all of that is sinking. And it's a byproduct of the last ice age, and it's sinking at about the same rate in Tangier's case as the average sea level rise of the 20th century. So what we have in that part of the Chesapeake Bay in the mid-Atlantic is some of the highest relative sea level rise on the planet. It's basically losing itself at twice the rate that most of the American coast is. And so that's the physical dilemma in which the island finds itself. The cultural dilemma is unfolding in parallel to that, and it's really another form of erosion because since the 1930s, Tangier has steadily lost population. At one time, it had 1,300 or better residents. It's now down to 460, give or take. And what you see is that young people aren't staying. And that's, of course, something that's unfolded in everything from rural towns in the south to native villages in the Alaskan bush. But what of course makes it tough in Tangier is that this is an island, and an island is dependent on some key essential services to a degree that mainland towns are not. You know, if you live in a mainland small town and the grocery store closes down, well, it's pretty doggone inconvenient, but you get in your car and you drive 5 or 10 miles to the next town and go to the grocery store there. Not an option when you're 12 miles from the mainland. You lose the grocery store there, and it's more than an inconvenience. It's existentially threatening. And so over the years, Tangier has seen its population wither, seen its young people move away, seen those remaining islanders age on average. The average age on Tangier now is in the mid-50s. And let me tell you, there are a lot of islanders in their 80s and 90s. And they are approaching tipping points for several critical services, grocery store being one, the mail boat, which is actually a private company, family-owned business, being another, and the school, the K-12 school, the only K-12 schoolhouse left in Virginia, which had 100 students in 2000 and will be down to 53 next year.
Right. You say of all the disasters that might befall the island, nothing but a killer hurricane would bring the end as surely and quickly as the demise of Tangier Combined School. And this is a really interesting situation in which if this school were to close, then for anybody who chose to remain on Tangier who had children, well, explain what they would have to do in order for their children to receive schooling and why it is such an unacceptable alternative.
Well, while Crisfield, Maryland may be the nearest mainland port, Tangier is in Virginia. It's about 6 miles south of the state line. And so you wouldn't send your kids to school on a boat to Crisfield, but to Nancock in Accomack County, Virginia, which is 16 miles across two very tempestuous sounds, Tangier Sound and Pocomoke Sound, which are big arms of the bay. And I think on boat savvy Tangier, there isn't a single household in which parents would put their kids aboard a school boat every morning and send them off across those 16 miles. It can be quite a white knuckle crossing. Even in fair weather, it's a long way to go. You can't very well, have kids taking tests on days when they've been seasick on the way to school. It would be a deal killer. They would pull up and move off the island. They would feel that they had no choice. And if that were to happen, that would affect about one third of the population right there.
Right.
It's a third of the population, which would implode the economy and force its abandonment. It's the entire island.
And I appreciated the fact that you point out that this is a situation in which what makes it very difficult to sustain the school is not just the dwindling number of students, but also the dwindling number of teachers. And where are you going to find someone who is willing to be a teacher, and the aging of the teaching staff there? That is a really essential element in a sense, the fragility of that school and the tenuousness of its very existence.
Yeah, and by necessity, many of its teachers have become certified in a lot of subjects, So they can wear, they can adapt to the changing needs of the school population from year to year. The science teacher is certified in every science that you can be certified in as a secondary school teacher in Virginia, which is, she may be the only one. What happens when she retires? You're not losing one teacher there, you're losing five. All of these people are, because of their training, force multipliers, basically. So the loss of any one is felt to an amplified degree. The teacher population is getting long in the tooth. The principal herself, Nina Pruitt, could retire tomorrow, and three of her teachers could probably retire tomorrow as well.
Right. In fact, you mentioned something early in the book about how a young man living on the island is likely to be both the homecoming king and the valedictorian of his class, even though his
graduate.
Yeah, because he is the one and only member of the class of 2020.
Hugh Parks, yes indeed. And there are many classes with just two people.
Right.
This is only remarkable by slight degree. Because they're, a big class on Tangier these days is seven or more kids.
Right.
And we may be at the point now where we'll never see that again. A couple of years ago, there were nine kids in the graduating class, and that was generally viewed as kind of the end of an era when those kids graduated.
I want to just spend a couple of minutes talking about one young man in particular. I mean, mostly we meet some of the kind of grizzled old veterans of Tangier Island, but I want to give you a chance to just talk briefly about a young man by the name of Cameron Evans, I think 16 years old at the time that you met him. And he was something out of the ordinary because you called him a true Tangier man, that is, someone who really seemed to love the island and loved the work of the crabbing, and is someone that in a lot of ways you could imagine being happy living there, and yet someone, a young man with a lot of gifts, great intelligence, tremendous potential, and he represents in a sense a really what you call uncomfortable reality for the people that live at Tangier Island. I mean, what do you wish for a young man like Cameron Evans, for him to remain or for him to leave?
Yeah, it's really a terrible choice. The island needs young people like Cameron Evans, who is tall, rangy, square-jawed kid who looks like he could easily. And he'd play a waterman in the movies, He's got the looks like a character out of Coleridge, and he is never bored. You talk to most Tangier teens, and I think that they reflect pretty much what you'll find in a typical cross section of mainland kids. They're easily bored, dissatisfied in general with their station. Eager to get away from home. And Tangier is none of those things. Cameron is none of those things. He's a kid who grew up, as Tangiermen say, with mud between his toes, and takes full advantage of his island existence. And as I'd point out in the book, if you were to poll older islanders, especially the watermen, who do you see among Tangier's youth who best kind of captures what you were like as a kid? Invariably, they'll say, that's Cameron Evans. And so Cameron, I think, struggled over whether he, at the time I was reporting the book, he was in the middle of that struggle over whether he would stay on the island and try to follow in its traditions or whether he would go away to school. And ultimately, I can tell you, Greg, he did decide to go away. He's going to be going to Christopher Newport University and Newport News.
I want to give you a chance to also talk about some surprising observations you made about the women on Tangier Island. And again, you spend most of your time, getting to know the men who in so many ways would seem to dominate the whole culture of the island. But you really point out the tremendously significant role of women in certain facets of society. And you say often they are the ones who kind of shepherd the collective thought of the island, and they are often the greatest catalyst for action on the island as well. Just explain what kind of the interesting role that women play here, and why, in a sense, they find themselves in that complex role.
Well, women run the show. A lot of the menfolk would never admit that, but women run Tangier, and of course, part of that's simply a function of for a significant part of every day, 6 days a week, the men are gone. The men are all out in their boats. Somebody has to keep the place running. And so women, I think, from the island's very earliest days have been its managers. They have run all of the island's business. They have run all of its communications. You know, and again, they have a landline telephone communication system that is very, very fast. Tangier has no cell phone service, so it's an old school landline that you have to depend on. But they have a telephone tree that cannot be duplicated anywhere else. I don't think it's unbelievable how quickly information travels. When you look at who runs all of the institutions on the island, it's women. When you look at who gets all of the interaction between government and island started and sustains it, it's women. They run the churches to a large part. The island simply would not exist if it were not for women running things.
Hmm. Tell us now a little bit about what you learned about the hard life of the crabbers of Tangier Island, and also say a word about the especially delicious crab that is found there. I mean, you really make a case for this being just about the best crab meat one can find anywhere. But just how hard and complicated a life is it for those who harvest crabs off of Tangier Island?
Well, you've got two kinds of crabber on Tangier. And by the way, they're called watermen because they harvest more than one animal. You know, in the summer, Tangiermen harvest crab. And then in the winter, most of them go after oysters. So you've got two different fisheries that you're chasing, depending on the time of year. But during the crabbing season, which runs from March to November, you're either after hard crabs, which a lot of us are familiar with from backyard crab boils or from eating crab cakes. That's where that meat comes from, is from hard crabs, which you catch alive, hard, adult, you steam them, and then you pick them. The other kind of crab that Tangiermen go for, and really the kind of fishing that has put Tangier on the map and made it an industry leader, is softshell crab, which is exactly the same animal. It's still the Chesapeake Bay blue crab, but it is caught when it's about to molt. So a softshell, a peeler crabber, as they're called, will put his pots out, and he'll pull them up, and he'll have a bunch of hard crabs in there. But it'll also have a few hard crabs that are getting close to molting. And there are lots of signals to the crabber that tell him this is so. And he will take that soon to molt peeler. And he'll put it in a water tank at his crab shanty, which is a little hut on stilts out in the middle of the middle of the harbor with a recirculating pump that puts water into these tanks constantly. And he'll just sit on those crabs until they actually molt, and then pluck them out of the water while they're soft. And you eat a soft-shell crab, legs and all, as is. I mean, you just deep fry it and chow down. And it's spectacular eating. It's difficult to describe just how fantastic it is. But soft shell crab, and you know, I know listeners in the Midwest are going to have a hard time imagining imagining eating a crab and looking at an entire crab with its legs sitting on a piece of bread in a sandwich. But soft shell crab is the way to eat crab, and this is the only kind of crab that you can cook that way.
By the way, this reminds me, I really enjoyed, among many things in your book, your account of a couple of different restaurants that are on Tangier Island. And you spend a lot of time at Fisherman's Corner, which is one of them. And right next to it is a restaurant called Lorraine's. And it's a little bit remarkable that a place so small would have two functioning restaurants right next to each other. I want you to tell our listeners real quick just a little bit about the relationship between these two restaurants right next to each other. It says something about Tangier, I think.
Well, it does. I mean, they've got a very convivial relationship. They help each other out when, you know, one runs short of supplies in the middle of the day. The other one will pitch in and help them. Is there competition? Sure. I mean, there's a finite number of tourist dollars coming onto the island in any given day, and especially on days where the weather is iffy and the tour boats are not full with tourists. You know, they're going to be hungry for anything they can get. It probably helps that the restaurants are not both year-round. Fisherman's Corner is open only during the summer, and I'm not sure the island could support two restaurants side by side for all 12 months of the year.
So the prognosis for Tangier Island is, of course, very grave. That is, they are facing the impending destruction of the island, barring unforeseen circumstances or very dramatic and aggressive intervention. In our last couple of minutes, I wonder if you could just say a word about what, if anything, could possibly be done to save Tangier Island? And how likely is it, or what would have to happen in order for such measures to be undertaken?
Well, I think that what islanders would love to see happen is for the federal government to step in and build a wall, a seawall around the entire island, and then to pump the interior of the island with fill to basically build it up above the tides. I imagine in the fondest hopes of Tangiermen, that would mean jacking up every house to accommodate this new ground in much the same way that Galveston was jacked up and filled in after the destructive earthquake there in 1900. It's the longest of long shots. To even call it a prospect is probably overstating how likely such a salvation is. I mean, we're talking a project that would cost hundreds of millions of dollars, most likely, for a population that's now at 460 and falling. And that would be an incredibly tough sell in Congress. But as I mentioned earlier, this Tangiermen are a people with a lot of faith, and right now that's where they're putting their faith, is that there will be that kind of heroic intervention, and that the uniqueness of Tangier on the cultural landscape will be part of what's saved, that this will not be seen simply in mathematical terms, you know, in population terms, but in that recognized along the way will be the fact that this is a very odd and interesting blip on, you know, on an outlier in American life. And as an outlier, it kind of helps define who we are as a people. It this is the circumference of the circle, whereas most of us live in the middle. And you know, has a value as spice, if you will, for that role.
In our last minute, I want you to explain how the book begins. with your account of a place called Canaan and how that relates to this overall story.
Canaan is a now-vanished hamlet that was on Tangier's far northern tip, and was populated for about 150 years before it was finally abandoned in right about 1930. And since its abandonment, the bay has come in and swallowed up the old town site, so that now the foundations of Canaan's buildings are well underwater and well out to sea. And the book opens in 2012 when an islander named Carol Moore took her skiff up to Canaan the day after Hurricane Sandy had passed, 60 miles or so to the east. And she found, now she had been gone, her people, you know, her forebears were from Canaan. They, grandfather, great-grandfather, and so on, all the way back to about 1800, had homesteaded there. And she could remember going there as a little girl and finding their graves in the marsh grass. On this day, she goes back in the opening scene, and she finds that the bay has come in and ransacked the old graveyard and left the bones of her forebears exposed on the beach. And I hope it's an effective scene in kind of setting the stage for what follows.
It really is, and a poignant reminder of what this story is really all about at its heart. The book, again, is titled Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island, published by Day Street, an imprint of William Morrow. The book includes plenty of photographs. The author, Earl Swift. Earl Swift, congratulations on yet another marvelous book, and thank you for being on The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.